food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival for, what is this, Thursday, the 12th of February, year of our Lord, 2015. Melody won't be here today. I'm going to fill in the first segment of the program on my own, and James Corbett will be joining me for an interview in the second and third segments of the program. Start out with the market report. Gold is up $3.80 today to $1,222.70 per ounce. Silver's up 5 cents, $16.94. Platinum is up $7, $12.03. Palladium is up $7, $7.78. We got down here in the paper markets. Dow Jones is up 103 points to 17,965. They're pushing right up against that 18,000 limit. NASDAQ up 55 points to 4,856. New York Stock Exchange is up 105 points to 10,994. U.S. Dollar Index is down 0.67 to 94.1. And crude oil had a nice day today, $2.44 up. Crude is back up to $51.28. You know, I've said earlier and previously that I thought when we're down around the 45 barrier or $45 mark, I said I thought that was probably about as low as it was going to go. There are other people who say it'll go lower yet, into the 30s, maybe even down into the 20s, but I don't think so. I think 45 was perhaps the bottom, but I'm not going to bet on it. The way these markets are, we could have $5 barrels of crude oil. 2 weeks from now, it's hard to say what's really going to happen. But for the moment, I don't think crude is going to fall any further, at least not below 45, and it may even go up ways. We may get it back up to $60, $65, and then we'll see. Is it going to sit? Some people think it'll sit around 65, perhaps as much as a year or two. And it might go higher, might go lower. We'll watch and see. What have we got for today's news? Here's some good news. Interesting news. We get doom and gloom all the time, and we've had a situation for the past week or more. Greece and Germany, and or Greece and the European Central Bank, have been seemingly at each other's throats, swearing up and down that Greece can't pay the bill, and Germany says you got to pay the bill, and we were having a war of ultimatums, it seemed. But here's an article from the Associated Press that says, Greece Eurozone make conciliatory moves on debt talks. Greece and its creditors in the 19-country Eurozone made a breakthrough Thursday, agreeing to launch technical discussions on Athens' demand to lighten the load of its bailout after weeks of acrimony. Both sides made conciliatory moves at the summit of European Union leaders in Brussels, encouraging investors' hopes that a deal will be reached to avoid Greece's exit from the euro. Greece's main stock market closed around 5.5% higher. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, said Europe always has been geared toward finding compromises. Compromises are agreed when advantages outweigh the disadvantages. Germany is ready for this. Well, after all of the screaming and shouting, now it appears that they're getting ready to play nice. But I'm wondering, and I hope they do, I hope things work out where maybe Greece can hang out at the European Union, and perhaps the austerity and the debts imposed on Greece will be diminished substantially. But Greece is hoping to get their debt cut in half. But even then, I'm not convinced that they can pay the other half. I mean, it will be just a gesture, I think. We'll watch and see. But I think if Greece and the European Union can come to terms here in the next few days, it may be that they're going to have an agreement that we'll see in the news that, hooray, happy days are here again. And I think what we'll really see is the days of kicking the can are here again. They're going to just push another year or two down the road before finally they have to face up to the fact Greece can't pay its debts. And Greece isn't the only one. This is not cause for embarrassment or shame. The whole world is so deeply in debt. You can probably take all of the people who are capable of paying their debts, and they might fit on, one steamship. Take one of the cruises to Acapulco, and you could perhaps fit all of the people in the world who are capable of paying their debts. I'm exaggerating, of course, but the world is awash with people who are so deeply in debt. Not just people, but nations. But the debt's not going to be paid. And when we get to the moment when that's understood on a global basis, that's when we're going to see, if we haven't seen it previously, that'll be when we see something catastrophic happen to the global economy and the U.S. economy and the rest of the economies of the world, when they have to wipe out the debt. Now, they don't want to face that. They don't want to talk about it. And they want to pretend that we can all pay our debts. But the truth is we can't. And probably the most egregious case of entities that can't pay the debt will be the government of the United States. They claim to be $18 trillion in debt. The John Williams, I repeat this on a regular basis, Williams figures they're about $100 billion in debt, $100 trillion in debt. And Congressional Budget Office, they say, no, we're actually over $200 trillion in debt if you count the unfunded liabilities. So it's never going to get paid. And Greece is just one of the first to fall. Not because they're more indebted than everyone else is on a percentage basis, although they're highly indebted, but because they're the first country to just kind of run out of borrowing power and whatever else is required to even maintain the illusion that they might pay off their debt someday. And they're sick of trying. They're sick of the austerity. They're sick of the poverty. They're sick of the recession and depression that's been imposed on Greece. And they want to get out and party. So they're going to get rid of that debt. I think they'll get rid of perhaps half of it in the next little while, in the next days or weeks. Will be written off, and then we'll begin to see how much they can really afford to pay. But before we're done, they're just the first of a number of dominoes that are going to fall when they have to admit, oops, we can't pay our bills. And what's the problem? The problem is that one man's debt is another man's asset. And that's the key point. If you can grasp that, you can understand a lot of what's going on in the world and the dangers that surround us. If I sign a debt free, if I sign a piece of paper, I borrow $100,000 from one of the people in the audience, and I sign a $100,000 note and says, I promise to repay $100,000 in 3 years or whenever, you can treat that note as an asset, and people will, and the banks do. They got a piece of paper, and somebody signed his name to it. They say, oh, this is worth $100,000. And the truth is, it's not. If anything happens and I can't make good on that debt, if I can't pay my debt is vaporized for whatever reason, the correlative paper debt instrument that we treat as wealth, as an asset in this country and in the world, it becomes worthless. We wipe out, if we could cancel, you know, we could sit back and say, look, wouldn't it be great? Why don't we just cancel the national debt? Well, the reason we can't do that is because if we cancel the national debt, we're going to have to void $18 trillion in U.S. bonds that people are holding in pension funds and bank vaults and wherever. And they're treating as assets and say, I'm a wealthy guy, I've got a U.S. bond. We cancel a debt, the bond becomes worthless. We lose $18 trillion in paper wealth in this economy, the whole economy collapses. They can't pay the debt. Right? Even if they could pay the debt, they can't pay the debt. They don't want to. They can't. It'll wipe out the wealth. Pay the debt, you wipe out the paper wealth. System can't stand it. Here's a second article that is also, we just saw that things look, maybe that there's going to be peace in the valley in Europe between the European Central Bank, Germany, and Greece. They may come to peace in the valley. And here's an article just a little earlier today, Vladimir from the Associated Press. Vladimir Putin, leaders agree on deal for Ukraine ceasefire. Minsk, Belarus. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday emerged from a marathon Ukraine peace talks by announcing a new ceasefire deal. But questions remain whether Ukraine and the pro-Russian rebels have agreed to its terms. Well, Putin is smiling. He thinks that we've got something here. I don't know if we do or we don't. If I understand correctly, this is the fourth or fifth time that they've had some sort of a ceasefire agreement. And, you know, we got a ceasefire deal. That's a good thing. It's supposed to start on Sunday. Nobody's likely to get, no one is supposed to be shot for at least a couple of days or weeks, however long the ceasefire holds together. They say questions remain whether the Ukraine and the pro-Russian rebels have agreed to its terms. Oh, there will always be some people that are fooling around. There'll be some shots fired, but by and large, we may be getting a dose of peace in the valley in Europe, and we might be getting a little of it in Ukraine. We'll watch and see. Putin told reporters the ceasefire will be effective starting from Sunday, but added that he and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko disagreed on assessing the situation in a key flashpoint. The government-controlled town of Debaltseve, a key transport hub between the two main rebel-controlled cities in the east, has been the focus of intense fighting in recent weeks as the rebels sought to encircle the Ukrainian troops there. Putin said the rebels consider the Ukrainian forces surrounded and expect them to surrender while Ukraine disagrees with that. Well, it may be that Ukraine is agreeing to a ceasefire just to try to get their troops out of a sticky situation. There are something like 3,000-5,000 troops, Ukrainian troops, who have allegedly encircled or very nearly encircled by the pro-Russian rebels. And that's fascinating because you're talking about the Ukraine troops are in fact troops or military. And one way or another, they have been outsmarted and surrounded by a force of pro-Russian rebels who may have leaders that have come over from Russia. That's been denied, of course. Maybe they're there, maybe they're not. But still, the rebels have encircled the government's military forces. Now, that's strange to me. It's embarrassing. It's like seeing a bunch of eighth grade kids that just beat the senior high school basketball team. I mean, this is cause for some concern. Seniors shouldn't get beat by eighth graders. Well, then the Ukraine professional military shouldn't be beaten by rebels, but it appears that perhaps they have. What else have we got here? Here's something from Michael Snyder. He says, guess what happened the last time the U.S. dollar skyrocketed in value like this, as it is now? It's gone up almost 20% in the last 8 months in terms of purchasing power as measured on the U.S. dollar index. For over the past decade, there's been only one other time when the value of the U.S. dollar has increased by so much in such a short period of time. That was in mid-2008. Just before the greatest financial crash since the Great Depression. History tells us that when the U.S. dollar soars, the global economy tends to experience a contraction. So the fact that the U.S. dollar has been skyrocketing lately is a very bad sign. Most people write that the coming economic collapse, who write about the coming economic collapse, love to talk about the coming collapse of the U.S. dollar as well. Michael Snyder says nope. He says he thinks the deflationary stage is the first thing we'll see. We're going to see deflationary, and we are seeing it. It may get more. It may get worse. We may see more deflation. Hard to say, but we're at least seeing it now. And he says first we'll see deflation, and later we'll see inflation. And Melody and I were talking about that just yesterday, if I recall correctly. I'm going to see deflation first, followed by inflation when the government gets its act together and says, oh my gosh, somebody's got to do something about this deflation. We got to inflate. Again, the problem with deflation is that it makes it much more difficult to pay off existing debts, and it inhibits people from taking out new current debts. The reason, of course, I've said it, I don't know, a dozen or 20 times on this program, when you have inflation, the value of the dollar is falling. And that means it's easier to pay off your debts. You get to pay off your mortgage with cheaper dollars. You get to pay off your car loan with cheaper dollars. You borrow $100,000. By the time you pay it off, it's only $90,000 in purchasing power, as an example. It's easy to borrow in a period of inflation. When you get into deflation, the opposite takes place. In deflation, we have circumstances where the dollar becomes more valuable. And you borrow $100,000, and when it comes time to pay up, it'll actually cost you $110,000 or more or less, but more than what you borrowed. You borrowed $100,000. If you have deflation, you pay back more than $100,000, even though the number is the same. Borrow $100,000, repay $100,000, but when you repay, the purchasing power is much higher than the purchasing power of the $100,000 that you borrowed. The result is it makes it much more difficult to repay our loans. More people default on their loans, they slide into bankruptcy. One thing leads to another. I can't pay my debts pretty soon. Melody can't pay her debts pretty soon. You can't pay your debts. And we have a very serious domino effect that hurts all of us. And the great danger of deflation, again, is that the dollar is gaining value. And it's a mortal wound to people who are debtors. Uh-huh. And that's what most of the world is right now. So I hear the music. That means apparently my clock is off or Frank's clock is off. But in any case, we'll be back in a moment with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. And we will discuss some more of whatever's going on in the world. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97%. Of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival for Wednesday night, the 11th day of February, year of our Lord 2015. Our guest is James Corbett. He is the author of the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James has been living and working in Japan for 10 years now. He started the Corbett Report in 2007. As an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Hello, James. How are you? I'm doing well. I can't complain. I guess I could complain when I think about it.
I wouldn't listen.
I know that. Nobody else does. You know, I don't think anyone would argue with the idea that you're an intellectual. Would you argue with the idea?
I'm certainly more intellectually inclined than otherwise, yes.
What do you think that means, to be an intellectual?
That is a good question. It means spending maybe too much time in your head and not enough time elsewhere, but I don't know. I mean, there's a number of things that go into that. I think it's really just, honestly, I look at human capacities and potentialities as different aspects of the overall human experience, and some people are stronger in certain areas and stronger in other areas. I mean, there's benefits, obviously, to being intellectually inclined, but then there's drawbacks as well, and I'm trying to more align the rest of my life with my intellectuality, but I keep using words like intellectuality,
so... I see intellectual. To be an intellectual, it doesn't just merely mean that you're well-educated and articulate, to my mind. A lot of people feign being intellectual. All right? It's an act they can put on and they can make a pretense out of it, but it's not real. For me, to be an intellectual means you must have a passion for ideas. You don't just talk about it, you have a passion for them. That's the way it appears to me. And based on that passion, you wind up, this is where it really gets conflicting with ordinary life. wind up with a compulsion to deal with the truth. You can't deal with ideas on the basis of lies. You can't accept them. You have to keep digging for the truth to find out what's really going on here if you really want to get to the idea, the heart of the idea. So I'm seeing a passion for the ideas, and to me that necessarily means you've got to be honest. And that can interfere with your with the balance of your life, because the world doesn't necessarily appreciate honesty as much as it claims.
Unfortunately. And let me put it this way. I mean, I've found with myself and the other intellectuals that I tend to hang out with that it's impossible to take anything at face value. I mean, you always have to scrutinize everything to the nth degree and look for the underlying hidden meanings and things that people may not necessarily be actively dissembling when they tell you something, but there still may be some untruth to what's being said, so you have to parse that out. And it's always questioning and questioning yourself and questioning everything that's going on, which, I mean, it is helpful towards getting to truth, quote-unquote, but it's extremely difficult to live in the everyday world with that attitude, because, you know, it does start to interfere at a certain point.
Now, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. From my perspective, we've got two major problems or flashpoints in the world today. One of them is Greece, and the other one is Ukraine. I figured we would talk about Greece for the second, for this segment of the program, and then talk about the Ukraine in the following segment. But maybe you've got something that you think is more important than Greece or the Ukraine at this point. Is there something else you'd rather talk about?
Not really. On the geopolitical table, I think those are the two things to talk about. And I just recorded and released a conversation with Rick Rozoff of Stop NATO International about what's happening in Ukraine right at this moment. So it is certainly on the knife edge there. And then, of course, as you say, with Greece, we are looking at the potential for some sort of Brexit or the breakdown of the Eurozone or something coming to a head. And it could be within days. I mean, there are really crucial meetings that are taking place right now.
So I've got a bunch of little headlines here. Eurozone, Greece fail to agree way forward following meeting. Eurozone finance ministers were unable to agree with Greece a final statement or a way to continue talks until their next meeting on Monday. We explored a number of issues, one of which was the current program. Dijsselbloem, that is, I got the D right, the rest maybe, maybe not, who chaired the meeting. The headline indicates Greece and the Eurozone are not coming to an agreement, at least at the moment. Is this just a very intense game of chicken, and one of these guys, either Greece or the European Central Bank, is going to swerve at the last minute to avoid some sort of a crash, or are we looking at two parties, neither one of which is inclined or capable of negotiating, and therefore we have a conflict of ultimatums? European Central Bank says you got to pay the whole bill, 100%. Greece says we can't pay more than 50%, maybe not even that. What are we looking at, ultimatums or chicken, or what's going to happen here?
Well, I mean, you have the new Greek finance minister, Varoufakis, I'm not so good with my Greek pronunciation, who's saying basically Europe manages to find agreements even if it's at the last moment. So it, at any rate, the face that they're presenting to the world is that this is just some, a bit of negotiating tactics and a bit of chicken going on, but eventually someone's going to swerve. I mean, I really don't have a prediction on this. I really don't know which way it's going to go. But I think from the perspective of the Greek people, I mean, I don't think there's a happy way out of this situation in terms of what's happening underlying the economy. The economy itself is what's really ailing here. And I certainly agree that just hooking themselves to the EU IMF troika yoke of debt oppression is not the answer, not the way forward, and to just simply take on whatever austerity mandates these various bodies put on this government as part of their bailout package is clearly not the way forward for the Greek people or the Greek economy. But then again, I'm highly skeptical that Syriza's plan is the way forward for the economy either. And I hope people have or will at least take a look at what Syriza is actually proposing, what their actual 40-point plan really is, which consists of some things that I think I would be completely supportive of. I mean, some things that I think are just on their face pretty obvious, like equal salaries for men and women. I don't think anyone would actually dispute that as a goal, or various things, using buildings of the government, banks and the church for the homeless, things like that. I mean, again, policies that a lot of people can get behind. And then you have some more controversial type of policies, ones like raising the minimum salary, which, of course, you're familiar with that argument in the United States, and the idea that raising the minimum salary is somehow going to raise the standard of the average worker in the economy, which I think is fundamentally unsound argument. But I understand a lot of people believe that if you just make McDonald's workers get $15 an hour, then everything will be better. So I think there's some controversial things like that. And then there's things that are just outright, I think, preposterous. Raising income tax to 75% for any income over 500,000 euros, nationalization of banks. I mean, the types of things that you would expect from a openly socialist party, but that I don't see as in any way actually helping to further the economic freedom, let alone the economic opportunity of the average Greek. So I think there is a definite mixed bag in this plan. And personally, I don't think it's going to be ultimately the way forward for the Greek people themselves. I would posit that the real idea for what really needs to occur in Greece has actually been underway for a few years now. Since the beginning of the euro crisis, we've seen in various Greek communities, like in Volos, we saw the rise of a complementary currency, a type of bartering system that was set up by the people in Volos that was completely going around the euro system. There weren't enough euros floating around the economy, so they set up what started as an 800-member grassroots initiative to basically facilitate local business people to trade. And they created a currency called the TEM, the T-E-M. And people can read about that online. I hope they do so. Again, this is the type of thing, it's not going to solve the national economy crisis, but it is the only way for a lot of average people who are just struggling to make ends meet and to get by to actually participate in the economy. And I think that really has to be the key. And once again, we can get lost at, you know, and bewildered looking at these big players, these big central banks and the IMF and things like this, and get and lose in that forest the actual trees of the people who are just trying to put food on the table. And I think there's a lot of different ways to do that that doesn't even have to revolve around this international political chicken game that's going on right now.
But the fact remains, they've got the fundamental truth of all of this is that Greece can't pay the debt. And regardless of whether they agree to pay the debt or they say, we're not going to pay the debt, the fact is they can't pay the debt, at least not in full. So we can maybe kick the can down the road a little further and last a few more months or a year, who knows, I don't know how long it can be extended. But we're going to confront this reality, Greece can't pay the bill. And there's no way of getting around that I'm able to understand. All the reports indicate that's the truth of the matter. So we're going to deal with this problem. There's going to be some sort of a crash here. There's going to be some sort of a crack-up. Is the crack-up going to be a catastrophe? Or is it merely going to be something of a difficult time and an annoyance that's similar to what we saw in Iceland? When they declared, that's it, we're not paying our bills. And everybody's, everything's going to collapse, you're going to burn, you're going to crash and burn. It turned out they had a difficult 18, 24 months, and they were back on track and became one of the stronger economies, at least for a while, as compared to the other economies in the European Union. Will Greece emulate Iceland to any degree, or is Greece headed for catastrophe?
Well, I mean, I think you're right to bring up that example, because I think that is the way that this crack up, this situation can be made into something potentially revolutionary, potentially mm-hmm. transformative, potentially historical in nature, because there is the concept of odious debt that has been accrued through means that the public cannot possibly be put on the hook for, because they did not have any say in it. They did not benefit from it. It was all done under the table by corrupt leaders for their own purposes. I think there is a case to be made that Greece's debt is an odious debt, and that we can trace this back all the way back to the creation of the Greek, the insertion of Greece into the Eurozone back in the early 1990s with the aid of Goldman Sachs cooking the books, and all of the underhanded duplicity of the various leaders who have come in that political office, the revolving door, in the intervening time. I think the debt that's been racked up in the Greek people's name is odious debt and should be overturned or canceled. But I think the other side of that is that that is a moral argument to be made, that there is such a concept as odious debt, and that the people can and should assert that when they are confronted with the situation like Greece finds itself in right now. But I think you forfeit that moral playing field when you say that, well, the next government is going to continue running up debt to pay for all these, you know, nationalization of services and all of these things that they're planning to do in their 40-point plan. They're going to obviously create more debt. And I think if you are coming into power saying, this is odious debt, we have to get rid of it, but here's our plan, and it's going to be racking up a lot more debt. Well,
yeah, we're going to get rid of the odious debt that's owed the other people, and we're going to create new debt that will be owed to us.
Yes, or that we will take advantage of. And I mean, no one can or should take anyone seriously who's going to say, you know, well, no, we're not going to pay those debts, but, you know, now we want debts. I mean, no one would extend credit to that. And I think that there's a bigger conversation that needs to happen here. But once again, I see that the focus of that conversation at the political level, with these political mouthpieces talking in back rooms, deciding the fates of nations, is part of the problem itself. That's part of the issue of what makes odious debt odious, is that all of these deals take place in back rooms between these political leaders. So how are they going to be the ones to decide, you know, what happens to this debt? And I think if the concept of odious debt has any real meaning in any society larger than that of Iceland, I mean, Iceland is a fairly small country, and you can kind of accomplish different things in a small society like that. But when you get into larger societies, and then you start looking at, you know, a piece of the Eurozone and things like that, I mean, it has to be something that's either going to be a popularly understood and popularly grassroots movement, or it's going to be political wheeling and dealing and just going to end up in the same place.
If we see that Iceland survived not paying its debt, and if it turns out that Greece survives not paying its debt, is that going to have a contagion effect that's going to take other nations? Right now, they're all being faced with people say, oh my gosh, the world's going to come to an end if you don't agree to pay your debt. What if it's not that serious? Is this hyperbole? Is the world going to continue to spin even if Greece doesn't pay its debt, or maybe if Italy doesn't pay its debt, or Portugal or Ireland or Spain? Will they set an example that we can expect other countries to follow? And we've probably got about a minute and a half or so before we take our next break.
Well, I would say once again that I think that the way that plays out depends on the actions that are taken from here to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if it becomes an example, I mean, it could become an example. We could imagine a scenario in which it becomes an example. We could equally imagine a scenario in which the current bankster oligopoly that runs and owns the system and makes the money out of debt would never want to see a large ringing endorsement of rejection of debt. So there will be a lot of attempts to undermine the country economically speaking, and we've already seen that. The markets are already playing carnage with Greek bond yields and the like. So, I mean, there's a lot of the factors that go into this. Ultimately, I think the chance is there. Absolutely. I think this could be a world historical moment. I'm just extremely skeptical of political leaders like Tsipras or anyone else coming in who's claiming to be able to solve this. I don't think it's going to happen at a political level. It has to come from the people, or it won't come at all.
Do you think they already... Well, let's save those questions for the next segment. We'll take a break for some commercials. James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com, and I will be back in a moment on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
have a heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free. 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the3w's.thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk here on Financial Survival with my guest, James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Let's talk about the Ukraine. Got an article here from Reuters. Headline is, Arming Ukraine Could Lead to Escalation of Russian Support. That's from a think tank. And my first response is, you think? I mean, isn't it obvious that if the United States or the West starts arming Ukraine, isn't it obvious that it's going to prompt a stronger response out of Russia?
How could it not? I mean,
I understand.
Yeah,
we need
I mean,
a think tank.
Absolute.
Do we need a think tank for this? I mean, we
apparently
could get that out of an
business.
Eighth grade. We could get that out of an eighth grade civics class.
Yeah,
you know, they could say, you know, they ought to be able to figure that out. I think one of the big questions from my perspective is, how strong is Ukraine right now? Is Ukraine going, the government of Ukraine, will it be able to hold this thing together and continue to resist the rebels and perhaps whatever support Russia's providing? Can they continue this, or are they about out of Schlitz, or where do you think they are? You know, we hear Russia, oh my gosh, the sanctions have caused Russia a lot of trouble. Right, but what about Ukraine? Are they solid or are they fragile?
I would say absolutely fragile in pretty much every sense, economically as well as militarily, and in terms of the situation, in terms of keeping the country together as a functioning nation state in, you know, early 21st century Europe. I think it's already, in some ways, the fate has already been sealed. I don't think it's a functioning country in anything but name anymore. And one, perhaps most, the most obvious example of that is the latest from Poroshenko, who just came out to say, we are ready to declare martial law in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And you can even take that from the Union Information Agency, one of the official Ukrainian news services, where basically they're completely ready to go to any limit to try to clamp down. And I think once a government goes to that level and saying that they are ready to declare martial law at a moment's notice, I mean, it's already civil war. And I don't think statements like that are showing that the government is any closer to solving this crisis than they were when it first started.
I agree with you. I think any time a government has to stand up and openly say, if you people don't do what we tell you to do, we're going to shoot you. That's what this essentially amounts to. We'll gun you down. It's evidence not that the government is growing more powerful and they can kick people around, but rather that they are growing weaker, more desperate, and this is a last grasp at some straws before they crack up. If the government is really powerful, it fleeces the sheep every day, and the sheep don't even notice or mind.
Uh-huh.
But when they say, oh my gosh, the sheep are going to complain, we'll shoot them, threaten to shoot them. That's indication that the government is losing its control. I saw that they're talking about establishing checkpoints. There's a new law proposed that anyone who criticizes the government in this matter, they can go to prison for a number of years. The whole thing is becoming an embarrassment. And how does the United States relate in this embarrassment? Do you think they are embarrassed? Do you think the Obama administration or the military, or whatever, say, oh my gosh, this is going to be, you know, this is going to be another disaster? Or do they still think they've got a chance to somehow save Ukraine from the rebels?
If only there was some embarrassment or discomfort with the way things are trending. But unfortunately, the U.S. Government continues to push ahead with this. And the latest is that the U.S. Congress is just now preparing its $1 billion package to arm the Ukraine government. So, I mean, if there's any sign that there is even second thoughts going on right now about what's happening, well, it's not being conveyed through the news cycle. And it's, of course, not just centered on Ukraine. There's a lot of different factors that go into this. I mean, another headline from United States European Command, EUCOM.mil, U.S. deploys more warplanes in expanding anti-Russian campaign. I mean, you can't get much more blatant than that. And it is part of an overall I don't know what to call it. War, I suppose, brinksmanship that is being waged right now. And I think the U.S. is 100% involved in that and 100% willing to push it as far as it will go. I don't see any sign that the Congress is going to hold back on this billion-dollar package or that anyone's going to rethink anything. The only thing that's happening right now is, of course, the negotiations that are taking place in Belarus at the moment. But no one is really expecting there's going to be a diplomatic breakthrough there anytime soon.
Do you think that the threat to provide military aid, another $1 billion to Ukraine, do you think that's intended to motivate Russia to settle, to help negotiate a peace settlement right now? Is it more of a bluff than an actual, we're going to send the arms and munitions to Ukraine, it's a done deal, or is this just a bluff?
Well, if it is a bluff, it wouldn't be in line with anything else that's happened so far in this conflict or many of the conflicts in the U.S.'s military past. I mean, I think they're going to continue pushing that envelope as far as it will go. And because there wasn't a lot of pushback at the beginning of this, when the coup-installed regime first took power, I think they're going to continue pushing it. And one imagines that it would have been a matter of a phone call from Putin to Obama at the beginning of all of this to say, you know, there is a line here. If it is crossed, you know, there will be war. And that kind of a phone call would have had consequences in terms of what has played out so far. That phone call, if it took place at all, obviously didn't include such an ultimatum. So I think that there's absolutely something that's going on here. And I think there is brinksmanship in terms of basically, the U.S. is trying to push that envelope as far as it will go. And until there is significant resistance to that, I don't think they're going to back off. If there is resistance, one could imagine they would back down quite quickly. But so far, we haven't seen significant, organized, and blatant out in the open resistance. Obviously, the Russians are helping with the rebels in the Ukraine. You'd be naive to believe otherwise. But there's nothing diplomatically going on that has been called that line in the sand or where things have been thrown down on the table. So I think the U.S. is just going to keep pushing and see how far they can push this along.
Yeah, there's the lack of negotiation. Just sort of a random event, or does one side refuse to negotiate? And if so, who is pushing to make this, pushing this closer and closer to war? Who's pushing for war, if anyone?
Well, it's difficult to see how this is being pushed into war by the Russian side. I mean, yeah. One obviously sees the ways that they are supporting and militarily supporting what's happening there, but one doesn't see the aggression in that, insofar as obviously the aggression is coming from the West towards the East as part of, as I say, a larger plan that we see taking place through all sorts of different pieces of this puzzle, the new USAF A-10 Thunderbolts that have just been deployed in Germany as part of this buildup that's taking place in Eastern Europe right now, which has to be seen as part and parcel of all of this. I mean, if this was simply a question of Ukraine's internal politics, then clearly, well, what does the U.S. or the European Union or Russia have to say about that? But it isn't. It clearly is part of a much larger series of events that are taking place right now that are leading us towards some sort of military confrontation. And again, it's horrible to think about that because of where we stand right now in a lot of different respects. I mean, militarily, technologically speaking, what that would be, economically speaking, we're at an extremely vulnerable spot in terms of the global financial system. There's a lot of really horrible consequences to war. And it's important for us to remember that a lot of generations in the past have thought war is impossible. War will never happen. We'll never see an outbreak of war in Europe again. And then World War I happens or World War II happens or whatever. We are no different. Just because we can't imagine a full scale large war happening doesn't mean that we're immune to it. And we certainly aren't immune to the consequences of such a conflict if it were to take place.
If you were the president of Ukraine, and the United States government offered to provide you with $1 billion worth of weapons right now, would you take those weapons?
It's hard for me to imagine myself in that position because I wouldn't
understand.
Be there at all. But, we have to keep in mind who the current government in Ukraine is and what side their bread is buttered on. And clearly they have thrown their lot in with the IMF and the European Union and obviously the U.S. military umbrella. So from their perspective, I think it makes a lot of sense.
What's going to happen.
Yes, well, looking at this.
Children. I mean, this is like giving guns to children and telling them to go play. Ukraine is going to be destroyed. And the only way to prevent that is somebody's got to essentially disarm or just say enough. The government, our country, if we give them $1 billion worth of guns, now you go ahead and shoot these people. Go shoot them. Well, they're going to shoot, you know, the rebels are going to shoot the Ukraine, the Ukraine army. The army's going to shoot the rebels. We're going to have disaster for the nation of Ukraine, and that disaster is certainly going to be enhanced if someone takes another $1 billion worth of firearms. And we know that if they do, or weapons, whatever kind of weapons come in there, we know if they do, Russia's going to be, and it'll be easier for Russia to arm the rebels than it is for the United States to arm the Ukraine government, or at least that's my guess. Does it make any sense?
It does from a certain perspective, but you said something interesting there. You said that Ukraine is going to be destroyed, and I think there are two ways of reading that statement. The one is the one that you and I understand, that the people are going to be ravaged, the infrastructure is going to be destroyed, everything is going to, I mean, the actual, not the country in the abstract sense, the actual country is going to be decimated. But then the other sense is politically, Ukraine is going to be destroyed. And that, I think, is the question that's on the table. Will Ukraine be able to cohere as a unit as it is now? Or will it crumble? Will it fall apart? Will it split at the seams? And I think that is the question that's more important for Poroshenko and his cronies at this moment. They care more about about Ukraine as a political entity than they care, I think, ultimately about the people and the infrastructure and what have you. They would rather rule over, you know, that piece of the map than rule over actual living, breathing human beings. Obviously, if this could be done without the carnage and the slaughter, obviously, I'm sure they would try to do that. But at the end of the day, I think their ultimate goal is to preserve the political power that they have right now. And that can only be done at this point at the barrel of a gun. So I think in that respect, that's why the $1 billion armament would be appealing to the government right now.
We've talked a little bit about Russia's weak response up until now. Russia really hasn't been made a powerful response to stop this problem. They've kind of just gone along with it and put up with it and figured they'd outlive it, or at least that's the way it appears. I've seen reports, I think, that predict that Putin is perhaps had enough. And you've maybe seen him too. Bill Holter, I think, did an article on it where he says, look, I think he's about at the edge and he's going to do something. Here's a report from Pravda. It says American experts believe that despite the fact that relations between U.S. and Russia reached worst points since Cold War, Putin delivered until Obama only minor troubles. Putin is going to hit once, he's going to hit hard, and what they're predicting is that there's a report in Pravda that says Russia has satellite images that prove that the United States government was complicit in the 9/11 attacks that knocked down the World Trade Center and also hit the Pentagon. And Putin is allegedly threatening to release that evidence. Do you think that's a legitimate threat? Do you think it's likely to happen?
No, in a word, no. I think that I've seen those types of reports going around, and they tend to go around this idea of the mini nukes that supposedly were used at the World Trade Center and this type of information. I think it's a lot of old disinformation about 9/11 that's being repackaged by all of some well-known disinformation people. So I don't put any credibility in those reports whatsoever. I'll believe it when I see it. And if it happens, hey, that would be amazing. But I don't think it's going to happen. The Russians certainly do know about false flag operations and do have the goods on a lot of NATO Gladio type operations that have been being conducted on their doorstep for a long time now, and many different operations. But they haven't said a thing yet. I don't see that changing in the future, because fundamentally my reading is all of the leaders here are all gangsters, and they may not necessarily be the gangsters on the same side for the same team, but they're all gangsters, and gangsters fight gangsters in ways that gangsters fight gangsters that yep. aren't necessarily always outright confrontation, because they don't want the ultimate gangster system to be brought down. They just want to be the gang that's ruling on top. So I think ultimately there's a lot of backroom politics that are taking place here, and Putin himself has his own vulnerabilities, his billions stuffed offshore in Cyprus and what have you, that I'm sure is his nice little parachute that he can get out whenever he needs to. So I don't think he wants that upset, and I'm sure that the FBI and others already know all about that and how to stop those types of funds. I think, again, all of these people are gangsters and corrupt. So I don't think, fundamentally, I don't think that kind of confrontation is going to develop. I don't think they're ever going to put everything out on the table. I'd love to be proven wrong, and time will tell if I'm wrong, but that's my assessment.
All right, James, thanks very much. Appreciate you being on the program as always. Hope to see you again on what? Will you be here next week, or is it?
I will be here next week, but not the following week.
Okay, that's fine. All right, James, thanks very much. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, if good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy